Good evening, everyone. My goodness. Where did you all come from? And I went back in to begin orientation for a few new people. I thought, oh, tonight maybe it'll be a small night. But you never know what to expect from life. Well, welcome. I'm certainly glad to see you. Thank you for coming out in such a warm and delightful day. I quite enjoyed myself. The sun, a little bit of cloud. And can you hear me in the back okay, Dan? Yeah? Good. Thank you. Well, over the past couple of weeks, we've been looking at a Zen text called the Ox Herding Pictures, the 10 Ox Herding Pictures. And there are a number of different ox herding pictures that were done over several centuries in China and Japan. I'll leave this book out. You can have a look at it in the back afterwards. You'll get a sense of some of the different styles of these ox herding pictures. But they were essentially designed to help us in our practice. The ones that I'm going to be looking at particularly tonight they were created in the 12th century by a Chinese Zen teacher named Kuan Shiyuan. And I think, as I mentioned in the first kind of seminar that I did on this, in Zen, there are very few maps about progress in meditation. Some traditions lay it out pretty clearly. Do this, and this will happen, and that will happen. It's very clearly laid out. But in the Zen tradition, very few maps. And this series of 10 pictures, I don't think it's really meant to be seen as a linear progression in that sense of a map as we understand it, but more as presenting aspects of our practice that appear as we practice, not necessarily in the correct order, whatever that may mean. And there are aspects, I think, that we should be aware of, since we will return to them again and again throughout their years of practice. So the pictures, in a way, are just to help us recognize, oh, maybe this is where I am at this point. So we've covered already the first four pictures, and tonight I'm going to consider the next three. And we may have to share, but let's pass these out so people have copies. Are we okay? Does everyone have at least one they can glance at? Great. So before we look at the fifth picture, there's something we should remember. It may seem that the focus of the pictures in our practice is on contemplation, or it's on, meditation practice. But really, that's only partially correct. Zen is really more about action and the experience of action. Some Buddhist traditions emphasize a kind of solitary sitting practice leading to a deep awakening, going off into a cave somewhere or a private retreat. However, Zen's perspective is that awakening arises from action. that action delivers us from our habitual mindset. Meditation does prepare the ground, and action ripens the fruit. When you look at the stories about the early Zen tradition, from the very beginning, Zen has placed great value on everyday activities. The early Zen or Chan monasteries in China relied on farming to feed the monastics that stayed there. And that's still true for many of the monasteries in China today. In China, unlike India, Burma, Thailand, the monks do not beg for food. They work the fields. They grow their own food. When the great 12th century teacher Baijiang Huihai became old and infirmed, his students tried to stop him from working in the fields, and even hid his tools from him so he couldn't go out and work in the fields, because he kept insisting on going out. Imagine some old guy kind of hobbling out with his fork and, you know, a spade and working away. But when they did that, Baijiang then stopped eating. And he famously said, "A day without work is a day without food." Clearly, he understood that awakening is not separate from the activities of our daily life. So let me give you one more of these kind of Zen stories that kind of shift the view that I think we're all caught up in at times about awakening as being something special, happening only when I sit on my cushion or when I get zapped by lightning sometime. So shifting from that to awakening as simply this very life that we live. So here's the story. A monk said to Zhao Zhou, a very famous Chinese teacher, "I have just entered the monastery. Please teach me how to attain enlightenment." Sometimes people come in the back room there, like when I'm doing Dokusan or private meetings, and they say, "Please teach me how to attain enlightenment." Anyway, back to the story. "Have you eaten your rice porridge?" asked Zhao Zhou. "Yes, I have," replied the monk. "Then go and wash your bowl," said Zhao Zhou. And that was his teaching. You know, don't we all really start our search with the desire to learn the truth, the secrets, the answers that surely must be somewhere beyond this mundane life? Zhao Zhou's wonderful, simple answer, "Go and wash your bowl," reflects Zen's basic teaching. The path, awakening, our daily actions are not separate. Go and wash your bowls. Awakening is seeing things as they are, not in transforming ourselves into something other than we are at this moment. So I think in the Zen tradition, awakening is described more as a kind of breakthrough in our consciousness rather than something we kind of think ourselves into. You ever tried to like think yourself into something else? Like imagine yourself as the hero of a situation, So anyway, so Zen says, put that down. Go wash your bowl. Right. Wipe the tears from your child's face. Help them blow their nose. Do the dishes. As a matter of fact, I think most events of awakening that are recorded in the Zen texts, in the Zen literature, have usually occurred during ordinary acts of daily life. And when we look at the early Buddhist texts, you know, from the time of the Buddha, they often show the same trend. Awakening doesn't necessarily happen, you know, sitting on the cushion. It often happens doing something simple. So here's a poem by Patakara, who was one of the first female disciples of the Buddha, became a nun, who in her later life became a great teacher within the Buddhist tradition. And this is the poem she left. Washing my feet, I noticed the water, and watching it flow from high to low, my heart was composed like a fine thoroughbred steed. This is her just washing her feet before she goes to bed at night, as was the custom in India at that time. Then, taking a lamp, I entered the hut. Checking the bedding, sat down on the bed. And taking a pin, I pulled out the wick from the oil lamp. Like the flames unbinding, such was my liberation of awareness. Who knows, maybe tonight when you go home and you turn off the light to go to sleep, sudden awakening. The ox herding pictures really emphasize this. They're about a very common event happening all throughout East Asia at that time in the 12th century. Young ox herder taking care of the family ox. So let's have a look at the next picture, which I think is called Taming the Bull. Yeah, number 5, Taming the Bull. Kind of a delightful picture. Here we see our little ox herder, and she's really quite relaxed. The rope is loose, and the intense struggle that we saw in the fourth picture is no longer seen. And yet the rope is still held, as the ox is tricky and may kind of run off at any moment without warning. So care is needed, but not as much energy. So our Zen practice and meditation are flowing more smoothly. And there's a sense, perhaps, that we have of being settled in our practice. And maybe we even notice a sense of joy or a sense of peace within ourselves. Our daily life may feel a little more satisfying. And I think we may find ourselves feeling more compassionate and more thoughtful of others. I believe in our practice is at this point we begin to become our own teacher. We've wrestled with our mind. We've searched diligently. And through our practice, we've come to this place of a kind of willingness to simply look at our life and learn from it. And it's not that the external teacher becomes unnecessary, but it's rather that our awareness and our experience up to this point has prepared us to make necessary adjustments on our own. And perhaps it's here that we first notice the oneness of action and awakening, the experience of our meditation in action. Notice the ox follows us in the picture, but we do keep hold of the tether. In the busyness of our lives, we discover how to live with integrity. It's not that life becomes easy or even that much less busy, unless we've made some strong choices, like to retire. And yet, with our mind and heart gently held, as the young ox herder is gently holding the tether of the ox, we're not buffeted. We're not buffeted about by the winds of what we encounter in our life. Our actions that we do are less reactions than, well, they're more responses to what's necessary. The unity, the oneness of the ox and the herder, and the unity of ourself with the world becomes more apparent. So the taming of the ox is in part the taming of our habitual patterns, our habitual behaviors. But the unity has always been here, always been present. But in our distraction, we become blind to it. So let's have a look at the poem that's here. And someone like to read that for us?
The whip and rope are necessary, else he might stray off down some dusty road. Being well trained, he becomes naturally gentle. Then, unfettered, he obeys his master.
Thank you. Each picture is accompanied by a poem in this particular series. Other series have other kind of comments connected to them. The whip and rope are necessary, else he may stray off down some dusty road. In our Zen practice, great effort is the cornerstone. And if we don't have this great effort, then we don't really have much of a practice. This effort is key for our sitting practice and also key for the many difficult parts of our life. And this great effort is even more important when things are going well. What often happens is that many of us will practice when things get difficult in life, right? I'm in pain, I'm suffering. I'll try anything, even sitting on a cushion facing a wall. But as soon as things start to get better, we slack off. One teacher that I practiced with for many years, Chosen, from the States, she said, so often, some young person will come to practice very diligent, and they'll practice for a while, and then they start a new relationship. And that's the end of practice. They're suddenly very happy. But she says that usually lasts for a month or two. Maybe 6 months, and then suddenly they appear again. So interesting. So I think kind of contrary to our expectations about practice, great effort really needs to be applied when things are going well, because we're so easy to get distracted. But great effort doesn't mean to grit our teeth and kind of gird our loins, to use the biblical expression. A great effort in Zen means full and careful attention. So here's what Suzuki Roshi, the Zen teacher who brought this form of Zen practice from Japan to North America, this is what he said about effort in our practice. He said, strictly speaking, any effort we make is not good for our practice because it creates waves in our mind. It is impossible, however, to attain absolute calmness of our mind without any effort. We must make some effort, but we must forget ourselves in the effort we make. In this realm, there is no subjectivity or objectivity. Our mind is just calm, without even any real distinctive awareness. In this unawareness, every effort and every idea and every thought will vanish. So it's necessary for us to encourage ourselves and to make effort up to the very last moment when all effort disappears. You should keep your mind on your breathing until you're not aware of your breathing. There's some meditation instruction for you. We should try to continue our effort forever, but we should not expect to reach some stage when we will forget all about it. Typical Zen teacher, right? Says one thing and then seems to contradict and say the opposite. And yet that's our human condition, full of paradox and contradictions. Great effort until it becomes no effort. I think it's like this. If you've ever looked after a child for a while, your own child or someone else's, maybe, you know, babysitting or something, at first it's really hard. You're so worried, you're caught up, you know, am I doing this right, that right? Making all kinds of effort. But after a while, the effort just disappears and you're just taking care of this little being. Ever had that experience? Or something like it? No. How about a dog? You ever had a dog? Yeah. At some point, the great effort we make, and almost whatever we do, becomes a kind of effortlessness. Like learning a musical instrument, right? Tremendous effort at first, and gradually becomes a little less. We're still doing, working hard. This is the Zen effortless effort. We master the instrument. Poem continues, being well trained, he becomes naturally gentle. Then unfettered, he obeys his master. When I read this the first time, and probably you have the same experience, I assumed that the he becomes naturally gentle and he obeys his master, was the ox. But now I'm not so sure. Maybe all along it's the ox that's been taming us. the ox, our Buddha nature, our big mind, the interconnectedness of all things, however we want to talk about it. It's been taming the ox herder. It's been taming us. Perhaps it's in their coming together, the ox and the ox herder, that both become naturally gentle. No need to defend oneself anymore. When somebody says, "You jerk." Whatever the case, our compassion and kindness flowers at this point. And obeying the Master, meaning the way things are, allowing our life to flow, is natural, and we see it as the harmonious unfolding of our own life. So let's have a look at the next picture, the riding the bull home. This is such a delightful picture. And for me, it's quite special because one of my Japanese Aikido teachers grew up on a small farm in Japan. And as a young boy, his job was to tend the family's domestic water buffalo that they used on the farm. So he would feed it, water it, brush it. And he told me how much he loved that buffalo. And he would ride it sometimes. And in the hot summer afternoons, when they were laying down, kind of cooling off, he would lean his head on its flank and fall asleep. And so when I see this picture, I always think of my Japanese Aikido teacher, who's now, I think, 75, still alive in Japan. Traveling home. This whole journey, this journey that we're on, is really simply a journey home. I was thinking, you know, while it's really delightful to travel around, go to different places, isn't part of the excitement and the joy about traveling based in the knowing that we will finally, at the end of our travels, return home with memories, hopefully, of good experiences? And certainly when I've traveled, even though it's been quite delightful, most of the time I return home with a feeling of deep relief to be back again. My own bed, my own place. Refugees travel with no home to return to, but constantly have to wander, or else they're stuck in a place that cannot be called home. How challenging and how heart-rending that must be, to never be able to return home. In this picture, our young ox herder is really at ease, perhaps secure in the knowledge that she and the ox are heading home together. She doesn't even need to hold the tether anymore. When our practice reaches this stage or this point, there's a kind of unshakable quality to it. In Zen, it's spoken of as reaching the stage of no return. Wouldn't you know Zen would say no return instead of like return? Anyway. So maybe our early enthusiasm for the path ran hot and ran cold, right? Came to the Zendo regularly, then stopped coming, and then we'd come back again, and then stop coming, sit every day, and then stop sitting. just natural. So earlier, you know, we're kind of distracted in our practice. But at this stage, there's a kind of ripening or maturing of ourselves. And I think a maturing also of trust in the path and of trust in life itself. And no matter who calls, or no matter what distractions Mara, the tempter, places in our way, we don't turn back. We continue on our journey home. Well, let's have a look at the poem here. Did someone else like to? Yeah, go ahead.
Mounting the bull, slowly I return homeward. The voice of my flute intones through the evening, measuring with hand beats, pulsating harmony. I direct the endless rhythm. Whoever hears this melody,
thank you. this poem calls forth our attention to the interconnectedness of all things, the harmony of the whole fabric of being. And there are moments when we all experience this, or at least sense the kind of endless rhythm of all phenomenon. Thich Nhat Hanh calls this aspect of reality interbeing, the endless web of causes and conditions that's woven through our life and through all things. But the poem takes us a little beyond the bare recognition of the unity of all phenomena. Our young Oxherder is at ease and in harmony with this idea of interbeing. Her small self, with its sense of isolation and loneliness, has been seen through as a dream or as a delusion. The I that puts ourselves in the center and expects things to go the way that I want them to be is no longer in control. Letting go of all sense of the small self, we ride the ox's back, and the scenery of our life comes and goes of itself. And the actuality of our life doesn't really change much, but we experience it very differently. Here's a koan, a kind of Zen dialogue from a famous collection called the Blue Cliff Record, that I think really reflects this well, this idea of experiencing our life differently. So the great Chinese Zen teacher, Yunmen, stood before the assembly of monks in his great grand temple and said, "I am not asking you about the days before the 15th of the month, but what about after the 15th? Come and give me a word about those days." And then Yunmen himself gave the answer for the monks, who remained confused. He said, "Every day is a good day. Every day is a good day." Is that true for you? Not true for me yet. There are some days I would happily recycle. The scenery of life comes and goes of itself, meaning no need to try and manipulate. Someone later on asked Yunmen, what do you mean every day is a good day? And his reply was, grandfather, father, son. And I think he meant the natural order of life. The grandfather and his grandfather's life comes to an end, and then the father's, and then the son's. Natural sequence of things. But I'm not sure that's what he meant. But can we see, no matter what our day is like, can we show up for it? Every day is a good day. Show up for your life. Someone is sick, show up. Loved one dealing with cancer, show up. Not easy. But how else can we be fully alive? How else can we fulfill our vows of compassion in this world? Every day is a good day. So let's look at the last one I'm going to talk about, the bowl transcended. So in this picture, in the bowl transcended, we find a certain quality that we haven't seen yet. All the pictures until this one, we've had both the ox herder and the ox, or at least the footprints or the intent of looking for the ox, representing for most of the time kind of two aspects, right? Me and something missing, for example. Looking for the richness or meaning of life. I don't have that. I gotta look for that. Us wrestling with our chaotic mind. Me against the chattering going on in my head. Our human nature and Buddha nature. Or the relative and the absolute, to use kind of more Buddhist or Zen-like terms. And so we can understand or interpret these pictures in various ways. In the previous picture, riding the bull home, that separateness is almost gone. Our ox herder is familiar with and very close to the ox. The relative and the absolute nature of everything is not seen as being so different. But in this picture, the separation that has so long kept us from finding our true home is seen exactly for what it is. And we find ourselves at the home of that longing that first sparked our search. Now, this state of equanimity that our young ox herder seems to be in may seem really far away to most of us. And yet, haven't we all experienced, even briefly, a sense of really being at home in ourselves? And what may being at home mean? Well, for me, the kind of qualities that come to mind are a deep ease with my life, a kind of effortless compassion, a flowing connection that embraces all experiences and reaches out when needed. Something like that, maybe. As T.S. Eliot, the poet, wrote in Little Gidding, we shall not cease from exploration, And at the end of all our exploring will be to arrive at the place we started and know the place for the first time. So perhaps at this moment in the ox-herding pictures, it becomes clear to us that the ox and me, the ox and I, were never separated. But the ox was necessary as a kind of expedient means, because we couldn't have undertaken the journey in the first place without the ox, because the ox represented something we can't even or couldn't even express in words, this deep longing that got us away from Netflix and onto the cushion or walking a path somewhere. Could someone read the last poem here? Right?
Astride the bull, I reach home. I am serene. The bull, too, can rest. The dawn has come in blissful repose. Within my thatched dwelling, I have abandoned the whip and ropes.
Good. So we've left behind our whips and ropes, the things that drove us to practice in the first place. And we sit with a kind of serenity, a simple serenity. Maybe the BMW wasn't necessary after all. Right? The Honda Fit is just fine. Thatch dwelling. So I ask you, what is your longing calling for? What is the longing of your heart calling for? And I ask you, what is your sense right now of a true home? What is your sense right now of a true home?